assumption is you probably already knew about it.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's programme talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Emma Hutchinson, and I'm the programme convener for SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I just have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be a talk on transferring the softer skills we are taught as actuaries to wider fields outside the financial world. This talk will take place on Tuesday, the 13th of February, and further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. On the subject of online registration and charging for non-members, tonight's talk is our first event since introducing these changes, so thank you very much for bearing with us this evening. We're eager for this process to run as smoothly as possible, and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have on the subject. So please take the time to fill out one of our short feedback forms, which can be found on the table in the smaller room just outside the hall. Unfortunately, tickets for our upcoming pub quiz at the end of January are now sold out. However, we do have some other great social events coming up, including an escape rooms outing on Thursday, the 22nd of February. And please check our website or email our social committee at social@sias.org.uk for further details. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £24 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students, and further details are provided on our website. The attendance book is in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign the book on the way in, don't forget to sign this on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get added automatically to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. Finally, a reminder to switch your mobiles on silent, please. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour and will be followed by a Q&A session with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talks, so we've made a change to the champagne prizes. And I will go get the champagne prizes during the talk. But there is now a battle on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA, regardless of number of years post-qualification. So please just state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, and please do join us for these. So back to tonight's talk. I am pleased to introduce Beatrice Mail and Marie-Lise Tizzoni. Beatrice and Marie-Lise are both consulting actuaries at Milliman. They both work primarily in the life insurance sector and have focused on retirement products and the at-retirement market. Together, Beatrice and Marie-Lise have collaborated with Royal London on a series of white papers about retirement. And tonight, they are here to share some of the findings from the latest paper, which aims to bring to life the problems that a cross-section of future generations of retirees face. Their work explores current retirement savings trends in the UK and how the choices and decisions that households make can affect the lifestyle that they can afford in retirement. So I'll now hand you over to Beatrice and Marie-Lise.
Thanks, Emma. Hello, can you hear me? No. Oh, there we go. Yeah. So good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this talk this evening. In recent years, there have been so many changes to the retirement landscape, which cumulatively mean that workers need to decide, largely for themselves, when and how to save for their retirement, without any guarantee as to how much money they may end up with when they finally get there. When retirement is decades away and life is expensive, it's not really a surprise that many people don't spend sufficient time or money preparing for their retirement. The challenges facing those in different financial situations and at different stages of life can be pretty diverse. And it's with this in mind that we welcome you to this talk about the challenges facing future generations of retirees. There we go. So during this talk, we're going to look at the purpose of our research and whether people are actually adequately preparing for their retirement, and why some people may not be preparing enough. We'll then look at the importance of engaging with one's retirement saving, the importance of using the right type of savings vehicles, and we'll also look at the role that insurance can play in ensuring people's financial future. We'll look at some of the challenges which may be preventing some people from saving enough for their retirement. And lastly, we'll look at some other issues in retirement, such as paying for expensive long-term care. Now, this talk covers just a small fraction of the research which we've done. So we did put some papers out in the small room at the back, but I think most of these have been picked up now. So we will make sure that SIAS put the link to the online version of the paper up with the slides at the end of the talk. To explore the challenges facing those people who are yet to retire, we created 16 representative example households. Each household contains adults of different ages and different levels of wealth, and different consumption habits, employment types, and compositions. And they all have different attitudes to financial matters. For each of the households, we projected their journey to retirement, examining how their behaviour, circumstances, and choices might affect their financial position when they get there. We also look at how people's story could change had they made different decisions along the way. Given that most people in the UK will spend roughly a quarter of their life in retirement, it's a pretty long time to be without a planned income source. And unfortunately, our research showed us that over half of our representative households would be reliant on the state pension in their retirement to cover some of their basic costs. We also found that over three quarters of our representative households would have to reduce their spending when they got to retirement compared to their pre-retirement levels of spending in order to make ends meet. So this is our grid of 16 example households. As you can see, we've got four different cohorts of ages where the adults in the household are 30, 40, 50 and 60 respectively. And we also have four wealth cohorts. So these cohorts are, firstly, our limited choices households. The adults in these households are in full-time employment, but they're on below average salaries. So their earnings are pretty, financial choices, sorry, are limited as their income barely covers their day-to-day spending needs. Next, we have the squeezed households. These households are financially stretched. Their earnings are modest, but they do have a little more freedom to make choices about how to spend their money. Next, we have the manageable households. These households have sufficient income to cover their expenditure and some leisure pursuits, and they've got good levels of financial freedom to make choices about how to best make the use of their money. And lastly, we have the comfortable households. This group is the most affluent in our study, and these households earn high salaries and have high levels of financial freedom to make choices about their future. So these households in total comprise a subset of Experian's financial strategy segments, or FIS, as many of you may know them as. And Experian, who are the credit consumer reporting agency, produced this FIS classification system based on the analysis they've done on real UK households. And they've got access to millions of households' financial and behavioural characteristics through their ratings. To bring some of the characters to life, let's look at a couple of them to examine their stories a little further. So firstly, we have Gavin and Kirsty, and they're our 30-year-old squeezed family. They stretch their limited disposable income and sometimes use credit cards and loans in order to make ends meet. Gavin is a caretaker and Kirsty is a sales assistant, and they jointly earn £35,000. They're homeowners, but they've got a large outstanding mortgage and they've got young children, so childcare costs form a large proportion of their expenditure. They've started saving for their retirement through auto-enrolment, and they've got fairly low levels of saving outside of their pension scheme. Another example household is Jenny, who's our 40-year-old limited choices household. So Jenny is trying to stick to a budget as she raises her child alone, and as a telephone sales assistant, she earns £17,000 a year. She's got a very low pension fund and has no savings outside of this. So for each household, we project their journey from the starting point, so the age that they were in that grid on the previous slide, to their retirement age. And this graph shows how we've done that for Gavin and Kirsty, who are our 30-year-old squeeze couple. We're modelling their income and their spending habits over their working life. And in this modelling, we've included key stages such as paying expensive childcare costs in their 30s, fully paying off their mortgage at ages 53, and then finally indulging in a few treats once their children move out of home when they're in their late 50s. And for all households, we've based the spending that they make on ONS income decile data. And we've taken this data and assigned the categories in it into essential, non-essential, and housing cost categories. We also model the growth of each household's DC pension contributions and the growth of that DC pension fund, as well as the value of any other assets they hold, such as housing wealth and pensions outside of their outside of their pension schemes. So these projections for each household bring us to an at-retirement position, financially speaking, for each household. To determine how each household will fare in retirement, we've converted the accumulated DC pension fund by the time they retire into an income stream. Now, we've done this by inferring a sustainable level of income with reference to projected annuity rates. But this isn't to say that our households do or should purchase an annuity at retirement. We've added on to this the state pension for each adult in the household at a level based on today's £8,000 a year. And we've also applied current tax rates to retirement income for eligible households. And we've not allowed for the income generating capacity of any savings held outside of a pension scheme. So then, to judge how adequate a household's income in retirement will be, we've compared the retirement income to their spending habits in the last year of which they were working. And so we've done this because we felt that it was a comfortable level of retirement income will be different for each household, and it will be based on what they're used to, their consumption habits, and their aspirations for their retirement. And throughout this presentation, we'll refer to households' basic costs, and when we do this, we mean the total of their sort of housing costs, so that's any rent or mortgage repayments they're making, plus their essential expenditure. So this slide shows us, again for Gavin and Kirsty, who are our 30-year-old squeezed household, how their income in retirement compares to those spending levels in the last year before they retire. And this slide is in real terms, so today's money. Now, we've modelled the income and the expenditure jointly for Gavin and Kirsty, and that's why they've got £16,000 of state pension income between the two of them. On top of this, we've got just shy of £10,000 a year of non-state pension income, and the total of these mean that they're comfortably covering their essential expenditure in their retirement. And they have fully paid off their mortgage, as we saw in the graph just now, and so they don't have any housing costs in their retirement. They don't have quite enough money in total to continue spending at the rate they were in the year before they retired. So our analysis tells us that they would need to cut back a little on their non-essential expending in retirement by about a third. Moving back to Jenny, who was our 40-year-old limited choices household, we can see that for her, her £8,000 a year state pension plus her £2,500 income from her auto-enrolment scheme isn't quite enough to cover her housing costs, which are in orange at the bottom, plus the yellow essential expenditure, which we're referring to as basic costs. As a non-homeowner, Jenny's costs are significantly pushed up by having to pay rent in retirement. So Jenny is worried that she won't be able to cover her basic costs. So this slide I'm not going to talk about too much. This contains a few of our key assumptions, but please grab one of the printed copies if there are still any there, or look in the online version of our report, which I think is milliman.com/rurallondon, from memory. To read more about our methodology and all of the outcomes from this research. So now that we've set the scene and told you a bit about how we've done the research, let's look at whether people are adequately preparing for their retirement. So this graph looks a bit overwhelming at first, but it's just those two bars of income versus expenditure for each of the 16 representative households. And here we've done this on a per retiree basis, just so it's a bit more easy to compare between households. So these ticks show that three of our households will have enough income in their retirement to meet their pre-retirement spending levels in full. These households won't have to cut back at all. And all three are from our comfortable cohort, which is the most affluent cohort in our study. But this does mean that over three quarters of our households will have to cut back a bit and reduce their spending once they retire compared to their pre-retirement levels. So even for households who are able to cover their basic costs, a lot of these households are pretty reliant on the state pension in order to do so. And whether the state pension will continue at its current level in the future is open for debate. And it's somewhat difficult to imagine that it will become more generous over time. So over half of the example households in our study had required the state pension in order to cover at least some of their basic costs. And the state pension represents 53% of the median household's net retirement income. Our 60-year-old limited choices household, who are Victor and June, see the state pension making up 98% of their retirement income. By contrast, Charlotte, our 30-year-old member of the comfortable cohort, sees the state pension only making up about 17% of her total retirement income. So our research has shown us that households aren't saving enough to maintain their current spending habits in retirement, and that many people are reliant on the state pension for a large proportion of their retirement income. But that alone is unlikely to be enough to meet their spending needs. So if left until retirement, people have three main options to be able to change their situation. They could work for longer, they could spend less, or they could downsize their home or otherwise release equity in their home. But in this study, we focused on downsizing as an example. So on the option of working longer, we modelled how much longer each of the households who are unable to meet their spending goals would need to work in order to maintain those pre-retirement levels of expenditure. To cover their basic costs in retirement, so the essential expenditure plus housing costs, our poorest households, so those from the limited choices group at age 30 and 40, would need to work for an extra 7 years beyond their state pension age. Other households who were unable to meet their pre-retirement spending in full would have to work anywhere up to another 11 years full-time beyond the state pension age to maintain their pre-retirement levels of expenditure. However, working longer won't be possible for everyone. Ill health, automation of jobs, and prioritising solving youth unemployment are all reasons why working longer might not be possible for everyone. And on spending less, cutting down on spending in retirement may not be quite as easy as it sounds. The average UK household spends just over £250 a week on non-essentials, based on the categorisation that we did from the ONS data. However, as this chart shows, quite a few of our households are already far below this average. So this graph shows the income in retirement that the limited choices and the squeezed cohorts, so those two poorest cohorts, have once their basic costs are covered. Some of these households are in the red, let alone able to cut back further. Next, downsizing. While 3 million people of working age in the UK plan to sell their primary residence to fund their retirement, certain challenges may actually get in the way for some people who are hoping to do this. The nest may not be empty, adult children may be living back at home, or there may be elderly parents living in the family home. Downsizing can expose people to the volatility of house prices, which may be a deterrent, and there may also be a lack of suitable property for people to buy and move into. Additionally, and importantly, the income that people generate from downsizing may not be high enough to bridge the gap to fund people's spending in retirement. So downsizing provides us with an opportunity to look at our first case study. So Victor and June are our 60-year-old limited choices couple, who live in the home worth £100,000 with their adult children, Glyn and Samantha. They own the family home outright, and they've always assumed that they will be able to sell the home in order to fund their retirement. They only started to save into a pension fund once auto-enrolment kicked in, and so their non-state pension is pretty small at just £300 a year between the two of them, as you can see in the first bar in the chart on the right. Victor and June were the couple we saw earlier whose income in retirement was 98% comprised of the state pension. Glyn and Samantha living at home has made it more difficult for Victor and June to downsize and to find a property that all four of them can fit into. If the family were able to sell their home and move somewhere more modest and were able to release a quarter of the value of their home, they would only be £1,300 a year better off in their retirement. So this only increases their total retirement income by 8% per year. Sorry, got excited there. So while they would be closer to maintaining their pre-retirement spending levels, having downsized, it doesn't fully get them up to the total expenditure which they were making pre-retirement. And the bar in the middle of the chart shows that top-up of income from downsizing. So let's look now at some of the barriers which may be preventing people from saving enough during their working lives. So this slide lists some of the reasons why households might not understand the extent to which they need to save for their own retirement. Firstly, many people may have unrealistic expectations around the sufficiency of the state pension. 40% of people in their 30s think that they'll be able to rely on the state pension to cover their spending in retirement. However, the reality is that for three quarters of the 30-year-olds in our study, the state pension on its own wouldn't cover their basic costs, let alone everything that they'd like to buy. Next, we have the retirement system. People may find it difficult to understand. The rules around retirement are complicated and they're changing. And tax implications of various methods of retirement saving can complicate things further. Just as a sort of basic example, under 35s on average think that they'll be able to retire at age 64. But the reality is that the state pension age for these people is currently 68. And whether that will change, we'll wait to see. Many people may assume that the rules which were in place for their parents' generation will simply apply to them. However, the shift from DB to DC, coupled with pensions freedoms, has increased the number of complicated decisions that people need to make for themselves. And it's removed any automatic guarantees around retirement income levels. A background issue is levels of financial literacy. Awareness of the importance of personal pension provision, may be difficult to understand if individuals lack a grasp of financial basics. By way of context, one in three people in the UK couldn't, when asked, calculate the impact of a 2% annual interest rate on £100 of savings. Finally, then, we have longevity. So misunderstanding longevity could mean that people may not appreciate how long they may live and therefore how long they need to make their money last for. Men aged 55 to 64 think on average that they'll live to 81 years old, while women predict that they'll live to just 79 years on average. But ONS figures, or I'm sure anyone in the room, would be able to tell us that the average life expectancy for people in this age group is 86 for men and 89 for women. Okay, so now let's look at the importance of engaging with retirement saving. So auto-enrolment has certainly boosted the number of people who are now making those important first steps towards saving for their retirement. And by October 2016, 10 million workers were estimated to be newly saving or saving more as a result of auto-enrolment. And this could mean that more households are less dependent on the state pension in retirement, which is sensible because its form could change in the future. Some of our households, such as Jenny, who is our 40-year-old limited choices household, could have been entirely dependent on the state pension had it not been for auto-enrolment, which tops up her retirement income through personal provision. And while this is a notable achievement, it doesn't fully solve the retirement problem. For a start, 1 in 10 of those people eligible for auto-enrolment have opted out. Households who are self-employed and those with multiple part-time jobs are being left behind, and might have to pay at least twice as much in contributions to match the benefits of someone who's auto-enrolled, as they don't have those benefits of employer contributions. Additionally, auto-enrolment currently applies only to a certain amount of qualifying income, which reduces the proportion of total salary being contributed, which for some households may not be enough. Now, we're optimistic that some of these shortcomings may be addressed or resolved in the relatively near future, thanks to the DWP's auto-enrolment review report, which was released at the end of last year, which outlined some proposals to address some of these issues and measures as how to extend auto-enrolment coverage. That these reforms are proposed to be implemented from the mid-2020s onwards. So our next case study. So just as a bit of background, with auto-enrolment, and you may all know this, but the system works such that employees contribute at least the default rate, which fully phases to 5% in April 2019, or they opt out entirely. Employees can't choose to contribute but at less than the auto-enrolment default rate. And if they opt out, they also forego their employer's contribution to the scheme. So our analysis shows that opting out of auto-enrolment, which may be a tempting quick fix for families looking to boost their spending power, could come at a high future cost. So we met Gavin and Kirsty earlier. They're our 30-year-old squeezed household. And they're auto-enrolled into their workplace pension scheme. As we know, they've got young children and high childcare costs. And while contributions to their pension schemes were affordable at first, at the initial auto-enrolment rates, by the time that contributions reached 5% of salary, they reasoned that they would rather spend a bit more money on treats for the family, and that opting out of their pension scheme was an easy way for them to afford this. And so if the family opted out, they'd receive 3.4% of their salary, more of their salary each month to spend on those treats, and then the rest would be paid in tax and national insurance after opting out. So Gavin and Kirsty go ahead with this plan. They opt out of their auto-enrolment schemes once it phases to 5%. But when they hit 55, they realise that they've not saved very much for their retirement, and so they re-enrol in the workplace scheme. And this chart shows their income, so the personal provision, which is in blue, if they did this, which is in the middle, or on the left, it shows their income if they remained auto-enrolled throughout their working life. So if they did opt out for those years, their non-state pension income decreases by over two-thirds. This means that they would have to cut their non-essential expenditure quite significantly in retirement in order to make ends meet. So I'll now hand you over to Marie-Lise, who's going to talk to us a bit more about making the most of your pension provision.
Thank you and good evening. So as B said in our earlier results, not all of our households were able to meet their income requirements at retirement. And this is despite the fact that they were all enrolled in pension schemes for the majority of their working lives. And so while auto-enrolment is absolutely a critical first step, it doesn't necessarily solve all of the problem. And one of the reasons behind this is that many people aren't actually engaged with saving for their retirement, and so they're not really ensuring that they're saving enough or considering how much they might need. And when we were researching this topic, one of the areas that really stood out was when we considered take-up rates for employee pension schemes where the employer matches contributions. Now, many large employers do offer to match their employees' pension contributions to a certain extent, and this can be a relatively low-cost and effective way of boosting people's pension funds. However, research by Royal London has shown that there are 3 million people in the UK who choose not to use this, and they're effectively turning down £2 billion a year in free money. So we wanted to look at what kind of impact this would make on one of our households if they chose to maximise their employer's pension contributions. So we meet Jason and Paula, They're one of our manageable households, and they're in their 40s. They have above-average earnings, and they do contribute to their pension scheme, but only at the default amount, because they don't take a high interest in finance, and they're just given some sense of security that they will be making a provision for their future, but they've never really considered how much. So the default for their pension scheme is 3% of their salaries, and their employer contributes a further 5%. But the employer will additionally match contributions for up to 3%. And so we had a look at how that would affect Jason and Paula if they chose to maximise these contributions. So, as you can see, this had a significant increase on their retirement income. Contributing 3% and this being matched actually increased their income from their pension fund by over 30%. And that shows that making a relatively small change, if it's being doubled by an employer, can make a really big difference, especially over a long time horizon. Now, unfortunately, many people in the UK, including a large proportion of the households that we studied, would not necessarily be able to make a large change to the amount that they could contribute. However, just adjusting and reviewing their finances to see if they can make a small difference could have a big impact, especially if their employer was also doubling that. However, we also wanted to look at households which aren't lucky enough to be in a scheme where the employer matches their contributions to see if making small incremental contributions would make a big difference in that case as well. So we meet Thomas. He is our 30 manageable household, and he has a good salary and contributes, again, some amount to his pension scheme, but doesn't think too much about it. As he's 30, retirement feels like a long time away, and there are much more important and interesting things that he'd like to spend his money on. We envisaged that maybe he was, I don't know, challenged by a friend, maybe some pensions information, to try and increase his contributions by a small amount on a regular basis. And so he was challenged to contribute 1% more of his salary for each of the next 5 years. And we assume that his girlfriend, Agata, who becomes his wife, does the same thing as well. So they currently contribute 3% of their salaries into their pension scheme, but next year they'll contribute 4%, and so on until it reaches 8%. And the rationale behind this is that making a 1% increase is unlikely to hugely affect someone's take-home pay, especially given the tax efficiencies, but it can make a really big difference over time. And as our results show, this resulted in them having 40% more retirement income from their pension fund by the time they retired. And that's quite an effective example, we felt, of showing how making a small change incrementally can have a really big difference. Unfortunately, life is expensive. People have lots of pressing needs for their finite salaries, and they might not feel like the right time to increase contributions. So we decided to have a look at what would happen to Thomas and Agata if they decided to put off that decision. So they decided to wait until a more convenient time to increase contributions. Unfortunately for them, life got more expensive as they had children and a mortgage to worry about, so it took a while for this right time to arrive. In fact, they wait until they've paid off their mortgage and contribute the amount of money that this frees up each month into their pension fund. Unfortunately, they're quite old by the time this happens, and so it's only for the last 5 years of their working lives do they quadruple their contributions from 3% to 12%. Now, as you can see from this graph, it's not had as much effect as they probably would have liked, and their income from their pension fund has only increased by 6%. And that's an issue with leaving it till later to try and make big changes rather than making small changes earlier on, because the total amount of contributions paid in is less, the amount of time that they have to make returns is less, and also most pension funds have some element of lifestyling, which means that the potential for higher investment returns has also been reduced. And that brings us on to another important point that we wanted to look at when considering when people are planning and putting aside money for their future, how they actually invest that money. When it comes to pension savings, for most employed people, decisions are made within a very structured process as they're investing in their company's pension scheme. So they make a conscious choice of what percentage of salary to take, and they are given quite clear decisions as to how to invest it or there's also a default option in most cases that has been designed by someone with expert knowledge. But when it comes to non-pension savings, there's far less direction and structure as to how money should be invested. And there's a huge range of possibilities as to how someone can choose to invest their money. Now, the right sort of savings vehicle will depend on a number of factors, such as the investor's risk appetite, the time horizon over which they're investing, charges, taxes, and the amount of money they can actually contribute will also be huge factors as to what's right for them. One very common product in the UK is the ISA. In 2015, 12.7 million of these were subscribed to, and it's really positive to see that so many people are choosing a very tax-efficient way to save. However, 82% of these ISAs were cash ISAs. And while cash is a very useful asset to use as a buffer against unexpected expenditure, when cash holdings turn into part of someone's long-term investment plan, it's slightly more problematic. And in the UK, there are 10 million cash ISAs which have received contributions in each of the last 10 years, which would imply that these accounts are not being used as a short-term depository for money, but as part of someone's longer savings strategy. And the issue with that is that over the last 10 years, returns on cash haven't actually kept up with inflation. And so sadly, for some of these people, the value of their savings will have actually been eroded away to some extent. And that's sort of the problem, is that for many people in the UK, a cash account or an ISA or a bank account is considered to be a safe and low-risk option. But in the long run, it can actually be quite a risky decision. Another financial product which we wanted to look at when people were thinking about protecting and planning for their financial future is the use of insurance protection products. Many people worry about their financial future, but very few do a lot about it. Three in four families have no plan to deal with loss of income due to ill health and just hope that the worst won't happen to them. But sadly, it's not always the case. And one in four families have experienced loss of income due to injury, illness, or the death of a long-term partner. And as well as the obvious consequences of this making it much harder for people to cover their day-to-day bills, this also impacts a family's ability to save, and particularly to save for retirement. So we wanted to look at how an income protection product could potentially help one of our case studies. So this is Gordon and Yvonne. They're our 50-year-old squeeze couple. They previously had an income of about £30,000, but sadly, their income was halved overnight last year when Gordon had to give up his job due to ill health. The top graph shows their savings after this period until the age of retirement, and the blue bars show their ability to save with income protection, and the grey bars show it without. And as you can see, having this flow of additional income has really helped them be able to continue saving. And that's really important in this case because Gordon's employer won't be paying into his pension scheme anymore because he's no longer employed, and it's very unlikely that Gordon will be paying into a pension scheme either. And so saving is increasingly important for this household. However, when it comes to making a financial decision, most people, well, everyone, has a finite amount of money, and so they must consider what the best use of that money is, and everything has a trade-off. So we looked at a number of different financial products, but looking at income protection here today, as to what the potential other uses of that money could be and whether it would be a more effective way of securing someone's financial future. So we consider a 40-year-old who's earning £30,000 a year and contemplating purchasing an income protection product that would provide 50% of their income. And we decided to look at what impact that would be if instead of buying one of these products every year, she invested the money as part of her pension instead. The income protection premium would be £340 a year, but if she invested this money into her pension fund instead each year, by the time that she retired, her income from her pension would have increased by £790 a year, which is quite a significant return. And obviously, the right decision will depend on the individual involved. But it is important to bear in mind the other uses that money can have when making decisions that can have very long-term effects on people. As well as looking at ways in which people can behave differently, it was also important for us to understand why people are behaving the way they are now. And as our research showed, that most of the households we looked at wouldn't be able to save or have enough money in retirement, we wanted to understand why. And so we focused on some of the challenges that might be facing these different generations of future retirees. Now, about a year ago, a year and a bit ago, the Financial Times Money section published an article which was called "Why Millennials Go on Holiday Instead of Paying into Their Pensions." And this article stated research that said a 25-year-old should be paying £800 every month into their pension pot. Many 25-year-olds are not in a position to do so, and it created quite a lot of backlash as it was deemed out of touch and fairly tone-deaf to the problems that people might be having who are in their 20s. And that was why we wanted to make sure that we were actually trying to understand some of the challenges that people are facing in ensuring we have enough income in retirement. So one interesting point is home ownership in retirement. An example that Bea showed earlier for Jenny, who is our 40 squeezed, her income was significantly reduced, or her ability to spend it on other things was significantly reduced due to the fact that she was having to pay rent in retirement. And home costs are a large component if someone is on a limited budget. Unfortunately, for people not on the housing ladder, house prices are at an all-time high in comparison to earnings. In England last year, the average house price was 7.7 times the average salary, which is over double what it was 10 years ago. And given that most banks will only lend people around 4% of their salary, it means that first-time buyers are finding it harder and harder to get on the ladder and having to save more in order to do so. Unsurprisingly, this has increased the average age of the first-time buyer, but it has also increased the median length of a first-time buyer's mortgage. And this means that there'll be more people still paying off their mortgages in retirement. And if they have managed to pay it off, they'll have spent a larger proportion of their working life either saving for a deposit or servicing a mortgage, which means they'll have had less money to prioritise something like pensions. And they're just the people who are able to get onto the housing ladder. Due to the increased cost of owning your own home, more than ever, people are expected to be renting in retirement. And research has shown that it will be estimated that by 2040, a third of all 60-year-olds will still be renting. And this causes a problem given the fact that housing is a large expense and most people will be on a more limited income in retirement, especially with renting, where rental costs may increase over time and someone's income is unlikely to. Another problem that we wanted to consider was consumer debt. This is a serious problem that affects a large proportion of people in the UK today. Sadly, one in five people aged 35 to 44 say they have to borrow money purely to make ends meet. And at the time that we did this research, the average amount of consumer debt in this country was £7,300. And it's not only the amount of debt, but the cost of servicing it as well is a problem. Despite the fact that we are in currently very low interest rate environment, the average amount of credit card rates when we were doing this research was 22.8%. So the cost of servicing this debt is very expensive. And when someone is in this situation, saving, especially saving for their pension, is unlikely to be a high financial priority. For the rest of the case studies and the household projections that we've shown you today, we've not assumed that anyone is having to service consumer debt. We have assumed mortgage repayments, but we've removed debt from the equation. But we thought it was important to consider this because it is a serious problem that does affect a lot of people. So we're revisiting Gavin and Kirsty, who are the 30-year-old squeeze couple that Bea mentioned earlier. And they have two very young children, stretch themselves to get a large mortgage, and they struggle and occasionally use credit cards and loans to be able to make ends meet. So we gave them the average amount of consumer debt, which was about £7,000 as a credit card debt. They only pay the minimum amount off each month, but even these relatively small payments are difficult for them to cover along with their other needed basic costs. And so they're actually having to borrow more to get by. This pie chart, which shows how their income is spent, shows that they've absolutely got no money for anything that isn't considered an essential spending. So we projected what their savings, their non-pension savings, looked like over the course of their working lives with the added issue of having to repay debt. The graph shows that for the first 8 years of their work lives, the debt actually increases as they borrow more to cover their essentials and also their existing repayments. In total, it takes them 18 years to pay off the debt, paying just off the minimum, and they've paid over 7 times the original amount that they borrowed. And sadly, this is a position that many people find themselves in, and so it's not surprising that people are not necessarily saving for their pensions, because when they're in a situation like this, it's not necessarily the most sensible thing way of protecting themselves in the future. Another issue that was important to look at when considering future generations was student debt. This is a problem which is only likely to affect younger generations, as student loans are much higher than they ever have been before. A student who would have graduated in 2016 and would have left university with an average of £44,000 of student debt. And interest rates are relatively high, with people paying up to 6.1% on these loans. Now, student debt is written off after 30 years, and so for most people, they won't be carrying on paying this when they're retired. However, it's a large expenditure that students are going to have to pay for the best part of their working lives. And obviously, this is likely to impede their ability of using money for other things, like saving, especially saving for retirement. And so we wanted to explore the impact of this on some of our households. So we're going to re-meet Tomas again, who is our 30-year-old manageable. Now, he left university at 21 with £44,000 of debt, but because the minimum repayments are much lower than the interest rate, by the time he reaches 30, this is inflated to £78,000. This graph shows the non-pension savings across his working life, and you can see that his ability to save has been dramatically reduced by having to serve the student debt for most of his working life. And this is going to be an additional financial priority that younger generations are going to have to consider, as not only might they be thinking about ensuring we have enough money to cover their bills, potentially saving for a house or thinking about mortgage, they'll also have this continual student debt repayment. And whether it makes financial sense for someone to try and pay it off early depends on their own personal situation. If they're like Thomas, who doesn't pay it off, then overpaying doesn't make much sense, as he'd just been reducing the amount that gets written off at the end. Whereas if someone earns more money than him, paying it off early makes sense because of the high interest rates. And so that will be a kind of complicated decision that someone will have to assess for themselves. And there are many other urgent and important reasons why people need to spend their money on things that aren't saving, such as childcare costs, potentially helping their parents with care costs, as well as many other things. And 9 out of 10 people do realise that they should be saving more, but just over half of them say that they can't save more now, because they just simply can't afford to. However, as we showed earlier, making small contributions to someone's pension scheme can make a really big difference, and so assessing the situation if people can possibly increase their contributions by a small amount is a really important first step to engaging with the process and potentially making a difference. As B said earlier, most people will spend roughly a quarter of their lives in retirement, and so this is an incredibly long period to go without any kind of planned income source other than the state pension. So our research covered some other non-income related retirement challenges. So the last thing we're going to discuss today is the thorny issue of long-term care, which is an important consideration when considering finances in retirement. Now, as the last election showed, this can be a very thorny and divisive issue as to how much people should be paying who and how. Previously, the government pledged to cap care costs at £72,000 as of 2020. But this only covers the actual costs of care rather than any living costs associated, hotel costs such as accommodation or food. Now, the Institute of Actuaries did some research when these measures were originally introduced and found that for someone who was having to pay for care, the average amount someone would pay was £140,000 before the cap actually bit. And that's a significant amount of money that most people are not going to have out of a retirement income. And so many people will have to look for other sources as to how to pay for it, for example, non-pension savings or potentially the equity in their home. So we wanted to assess how many of our households would have the savings to be able to afford to pay this £140,000 figure. And as you can see, only three of our families have managed to do so. It's no surprise that they're the wealthiest of the people we looked at. But if persuading people to save for retirement is difficult, persuading people that they might need to be saving for care homes is even harder, as it doesn't have any, or for most people, it doesn't have any positive connotations. And the problem is that people's understanding and expectations make this job much harder. Many people don't think we have to pay for the care. We live in a country where paying for healthcare is literally a foreign concept, and so it's a surprise to many people that they might have to pay for these costs. On top of this, people that do realise they have to pay drastically underestimate the cost that this will cause, and they underestimate the chances of them actually needing the care in the first place. And even when people are confronted with all of the facts, they still think that they'll be fine because they suffer from an optimism bias, which means that they just assume that negative events are more likely to happen to people that aren't them. And so that's why there's not a hugely well-developed market for long-term care products in this country, because insurers have really struggled to find a market for people that would actually want to buy them. And so that brings us to the end of the things we were going to discuss this evening. Our full research paper does include a greater number of case studies and more detail of the things that we have discussed this evening. And as Bea said, there were copies in the other room, but they may have all gone now. But it is available online, so if you just Google it, and we can give SIAS the link to make that easier. But to summarise, our research showed that most households are likely to not have enough income in retirement, and unrealistic expectations of this really make the challenge harder. However, we've shown that making informed and proactive decisions can have a really big difference. However, there are still some really significant barriers which shouldn't be underestimated as to how to achieve this. Thank you for listening, and we're happy to take any questions you might have.
I'd just like to remind everyone, if you would like to be in with the chance of winning a bottle of champagne, please just introduce yourself if you're asking the question, and let us know if you're a fellow or a student. Thank you very much, Beatrice and Marlies.
Martin White, thank you for those presentations and for all the work. Having looked through this while you were talking, there were a lot of questions I had about the detailed assumptions that I can't see here. Things like exactly what did you assume instead of in terms of lifestyling for the mix of investments? Is it assumed that there's annuitization at retirement? What kind of quality of retirement income are you assuming? Now, I'm sure maybe you can answer some of those questions, but I'd also be interested to know whether it's possible to delve behind the detail at some stage as well.
Sure, of course. So to answer your questions in turn, we did assume a level of lifestyling of the pension funds investments, and I think there are some details of those in the appendix, which is at the back, but we can certainly talk about that further offline, because I don't have a copy in front of me, so I can't promise that everything's in there. Your second question was regarding
annuitisation.
So for each of the households, we took a sustainable level of retirement income with reference to projected future annuity rates. So in a roundabout way, yes, but we're not saying that those households would or should purchase an annuity. We just kind of took a projected rate as a... Yes.
It would be good to have brought that out because over a 30-year retirement, there's not many difference.
Indeed, yeah, that's true, and that's useful feedback. And then lastly, you asked about the quality of retirement income?
Well, that was my comment.
Oh, I see. Okay.
My name is Ian McKeever, and I'm not a student. Indeed, I'm probably at the other end of the scale. My first point is that I'm looking at retirement fairly soon, and investment is a big problem because I'm expecting to. I've got a working assumption that I'm going to live for 30 years. I have to make some sort of assumption, and in that time, I'm expecting the all share index to drop by 50% on at least two occasions. I'm expecting gilt yields and inflation to rise to 10% at some point during that time. I'm not entirely clear how ordinary people are supposed to deal with those two issues and deal with that in their investment, because they could actually retire just as the all-share index has dropped by 50% and inflation is up to 10%. My other point is, at the end you talk about long-term care. Has anybody done any work on mortality of people entering long-term care? Because I have heard it reported that entering long-term care is akin to a bereavement in the family, and that mortality on entering long-term care is particularly heavy and then improves with time as residents get used to the new lifestyle. So actually the mortality that we as actuaries normally assume is possibly incorrect. And I make the third point that you talk about people being unable to save for retirement because they fall ill in the interim with long-term medical issues. I would have thought that would have reduced their mortality, that it would reduce their life expectancy and made their pension cheaper because they would be expected to live for a shorter period of time. Have you done anything about joining those two things together? Because clearly if they can't work because they're ill, that may well have an effect on their life expectancy and pension costs. So it seems to me that that those two factors interact. So A, they don't spend, so they don't save so much, but B, the cost drops or could drop.
So that's not something that we've considered in terms of the mortality on entering long-term care. The scope of the research was to kind of get to that at-retirement position and then sort of comparing those levels of income rather than modelling the full journey once in retirement. But that is certainly something that sort of sounds like an interesting issue, and maybe you should look out for us producing some research on that in the not-too-distant future. And then on your question regarding kind of short-term economic assumptions, we didn't allow for that. We took, I can't remember, it will say in our paper where we took our economic assumptions from, but given that for some households it was a very long horizon, and for households we were happy to take a sort of an average expected return on equity, and we assumed in our assumptions that households who are within, say, 5 years of retirement probably wouldn't be heavily invested in equity, so they would have less exposure, perhaps, to 50% drop, which you predict, compared to some of the younger households who may be able to weather that storm. It could do. But yeah, I mean, that could be a sort of a scenario that we could use for kind of further investigation into that. So thank you.
Stephen Baxter, fellow. Thank you for a fascinating paper and presentation. I think it really does highlight some really important social issues around savings for retirement that we have in the UK. You looked at a number of different ways that people can adjust their expectations and do interventions, but I think throughout you were assuming that that people would draw their retirement income from effectively the state pension age. And of course, one of the expectations we could reset is the age at which you may be able to retire, and it may be very different to the current state pension age projections. I just wondered if you'd looked at how much you might have to move those retirement ages as the consequence of some of the inaffordability of basic expenditure, or indeed ensuring you can cover your non-essential expenditure, and if there was any indicative numbers you could share with us and perhaps how it might vary between generations and circumstances.
Yeah, sure. So for we did do that. So I think it was an extra 5 years. I can't remember what was on the slide. There were some
7 years.
Yeah, so there were a couple of the poorest households had to work another 7 years beyond their state pension age in order to cover the basic costs, so the housing plus essential expenditure, when they weren't able to do so at the point of retirement. And then some households who weren't able to meet their pre-retirement levels of expenditure in full, so the housing costs, essential plus non-essential, had to work anywhere up to another 11 years longer. Some households it was just 1 or 2 years because they were kind of quite close. I think Gavin and Kirsty, our 30-year-old squeezed, who seems to be our favourites who we talk about the most, they only had an extra year or two, I think, from memory. So that is something we looked at, and I think it is one that's quite interesting. And I certainly think it's sensible for people to maybe assume that they need to continue to work a bit longer than they might have seen their parents or grandparents working. So yeah, thank you.
Hi, Neville Kent, fellow. I'd like to thank you both for a very depressing presentation, actually. And I say, really, on a depressing note, was I noticed three of your four cohorts in the comfortable brackets were obviously meeting their expectations, but one of them wasn't, which was the age 50. And I wonder whether you could comment on what was really holding back that cohort.
I know the answer on that one. So that household hadn't fully paid off their mortgage by the time they retired. So they had some housing costs in the last year of their working life, which kind of pushed up their spending. And so I think it was only slightly above their retirement income. And actually, in the long-term care slide, which Mary-Lee shared, that household had one of the highest levels of non-retirement savings. So we didn't, in our research, spend too long talking about or sort of doing scenarios for the wealthiest households, because in general they're fine. So for that household in practice, maybe they would use some of that savings to pay off their mortgage, and then their income would more than cover their spending in retirement. But there was no significant event for them, which means that they faced disaster and sort of weren't able to eat anything other than cat food in their retirement.
And I think that that particular family, maybe one of the adults worked part-time during some of the child's education, which obviously reduced some of their ability to have pension contributions during part of that period.
And they were also the ones who had their... we got quite involved with these households during the research. I feel like we knew them. They were the household who had their adult children living at home, I think, and so they that sort of increased their spending because they were paying for their kids' nights out and things after they were living back at home after uni. So, I think that pushed up their costs, which brought down their savings.
Roger Hill, a fellow. You don't seem to have made any inclusion in your calculations that I can see for inheritance and the cascade effect. I realise, obviously, the tax man and care costs will come into it, but there should be a lot of money to roll down the generations, although they won't get it till they're 65, but that's a different issue.
So
think in the modelling for some of the more affluent cohorts, we did assume that they would probably likely inherit some amount from their parents, but it wasn't something that we focused a huge amount on, to be honest. But that definitely was included for some of the more affluent cohorts where we assumed that they would be likely to inherit money from their families.
Yeah, I think any inheritances which we modelled which weren't spent on nice holidays or a new car was then lumped in with their kind of non-personal savings, so we weren't converting that into a retirement income for those households.
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Roger Hill.
Sorry, I'm Colin Keating, I'm a guest. I'm also a pensioner and have been for rather a while. The couple of questions for you. Why is it unthinkable that state pension, basic state pension, can't improve? We have one of the most niggardly state pensions in the developed world. Even in historic terms, at 5% of GDP, it's unusually low. So I wonder if that is such an unthinkable. On which note, given the relative strength of pension systems, if you're young, spend your money going on holiday overseas and have a look at their pension systems while you're there. absolutely. But the serious question is, can you really consider state pension, basic state pension, only in this? Particularly when you have things like housing benefit and no less than 8 possible benefit structures available for pensioners, most of which most pensioners don't appear to be aware of, but they exist. That leads you, in a lot of cases, to some very different conclusions from those you have made today. A question, anyway.
No, I didn't mean to sound too dramatic in my thoughts on the state pension. I think it's just, at least in my working life, I've seen the kind of, you know, triple lock being sort of talked about that being reduced, and for me personally, I'm not banking on that providing me with the lifestyle that I would like to enjoy in my retirement. I think the comment is that personal provision is important, and people, while there's no suggestion that it will decrease, there's, you know, it doesn't seem sensible for people to plan on government policy for what might be 45 years' time. And on your comment regarding other benefits, we wanted to focus on something that, given current policy, everyone who's done enough years of national insurance contributions, etc., will receive. We looked into housing benefits, and it was the policy was so different from even kind of a, what's it called, like a local authority to local authority, that it didn't seem it was difficult to find the exact rules, and also it was so various depending on geography that it would require further assumptions about where they lived and things like that, which, although our households were quite colourfully detailed, we didn't include exact postcodes in that. So it's something that we thought we can layer on in commentary, but we didn't explicitly model.
Philip Ingram, fellow. If I understood it correctly, your paper kind of implicitly assumes a 100% replacement ratio of the income at retirement. So, it's not normal to do that, is it? Because of, I don't know, travel to work and, clothes in the office and all those sorts of things that allegedly you're not going to spend at retirement. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
So we looked at some ONS expenditure for people who were pre-65 and post-65, similar amount of income, and we didn't really see that people were spending less. And although it's true, like, some people's costs will go down equally, they have more free time, so some people's leisure pursuits may also be expensive and go up. And while we did look at a lot of alternative ideas, such as replacement ratios, and we did do a lot of reading on the subject, we felt that most people probably don't want to see a significant depreciation in the amount of money they have to spend on retiring. So that seemed to be the fairest baseline to compare against, because it's quite hard for us to say, oh, people will definitely be happy with just 80% less of the money than they used to have. And so that's was why we sort of took this approach to kind of compare it to how much they were spending before retirement, on the assumption that most people will be happy if they're able to sort of maintain their quality of life.
Yeah, I agree. There's just a hand up there.
Thanks. Colin, hi, fellow. Just trying to think of some solutions for the millennials and the younger cohort who are clearly not putting enough in. I guess auto-escalation could be one thing. Any other ideas on solutions for that group of people to get them to save more?
I think this isn't a Milliman House view, but it's not something we covered too extensively in our research. But I think that awareness is really like one big part of the issue, and making it easy for people to kind of add top-ups or engage more with their retirement savings. So I think that providers who have got apps, like I've got a pension with Aviva, I go on that app far too often every day, which I know is really silly for something which is mainly equity, but I'm finding that being able to just really easily access what's sort of the performance of that, and I think this agrees with some research you told me about, of just kind of making people see the value of that and it growing, really helps engagement and gives people more of an ownership of money compared to something going into a fund and you receive a printed statement through the post to your parents' house every year, which you don't necessarily engage with to quite the same extent. So I think continuing to invest in those digital offerings which help people who are glued to their smartphones engage more, I think, is a really good starting block. Don't know about you, Marilise.
Yeah, and I think things like the pensions dashboard that might bring in make it easier for people to sort of track their pension funds if they move jobs a lot, which is predicted to be a big thing, especially for younger generations. And I know that there's been some research that one advantage of pensions freedoms was that it made people feel that their pension fund was actually theirs rather than money being taken out of their paychecks to go to something that didn't belong to them. And as Bea was saying, I think that kind of idea of ownership over your pension fund, being able to access it easily to see how it's doing and see how your contributions are making a difference is important, because I think there was some research that after it gets over £10,000 something, people start to think that that's quite a significant amount of money, and it brings them some level of positive feelings to know that they've got that somewhere safe for them. So yeah, I think the idea of just engaging and sort of owning the idea that you do have some money somewhere for you that is going to help you when you get older is a definitely important first step.
Joseph Hook, student. Did you find any evidence looking at employee pension schemes that maybe there's sort of a discriminatory element towards lower earners, and that actually those who are maybe in more professional roles or higher earners actually get better pension treatment, and that's part of the problem?
I can't remember off the top of my head that was a trend that we noticed. A lot of when we were looking at research, recent research on defined contribution rates, it had been quite significantly skewed due to auto-enrollment, so it was on the lower side, just because of more people contributing to those statistics, but with like one-to-one ratios, which obviously skews them quite a lot. And then when we went back to previous years, which may be more reflective of some of the pre-existing retirement schemes, they were much higher than auto-enrollment, and I guess you could infer that maybe people whose jobs are enrolling them on to just because of auto-enrollment may likely to have been sort of maybe low-income, less professional jobs, but that's an inference, and I don't think we specifically noted that when we were sort of researching contribution rates.
I'm really sorry, I didn't catch your name either.
Joseph Hook.
Krupa Patel Fellow. The question I had was one related to your research, maybe whether you came across it or not. Did you see any evidence of any particular route that would influence people's decision? Like, was there actually any information about what drove increases in their contribution, whether that was from education through government information or elsewhere? Their choices.
So, where we have examples of people who increased their contribution, that was just kind of based on our case studies and our tweaking their income up because we thought it might be a good idea for them to do it for 1% more each year. In terms of sort of analysing the most influential sources, that's not something we sort of directly did. But I remember in our conversations with Royal London, when we were sort of discussing our results as we went through, their comment was that people like Martin Lewis, money saving expert, he's kind of not disproportionately influential, but just massively influential on people's financial choices and things. So it was sort of interesting to hear that comment in that. You know, kind of media figures are pretty influential compared to what you might assume would be the kind of product provider or financial advisor sphere of influence. So, yeah, I think that's certainly something that is interesting, and I think that that could really help the engagement piece, identifying the sources who are most influential when it comes to people's financial behaviour.
And incidentally, I gave this talk to some of my family relatives, and after listening to it, they increased their pension. So this talk, yeah. Also influential.
I increased mine as well doing this research. I mean, scared stiff from it. But we don't mean it to be a kind of doom and gloom horror story, and we hope that some of the case studies show that actually small changes can make a big difference. So that's the positive headline.
Philip Ingram, fellow again. I just wondered if you happen to know what proportion of the population your 16 case studies kind of approximately covers, because I do notice that there's no government employees in there, which of course are still in DB scheme, which you know, and actually for the new care schemes for the lower paid employees are actually a pretty good scheme. So I just wondered if you knew whether this covered half the population or whatever, something.
So to answer your first point, I think there were about 50 different Experian financial segments, and we took 16 of them. And the way we chose them is we didn't want to include super, super rich or people that weren't able to hold down a full-time job. It was sort of, while it ranged from quite low to quite high income, there were sort of boundaries set. I don't know specifically the proportion.
About a third, I'd say, if each group's about 2%.
Yeah, it is information that we have, so we could work it out. And then to answer your point about no government employees, the brief for this was very much defined contribution, and so we didn't include or want to include people that were on defined benefit pension schemes. That wouldn't have really helped us in this instance. Mm.
Fewer challenges for those people as well, I suppose.
I hope it's okay to come back a second time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like to congratulate you on what you've achieved. I mean, it's obviously, it is very simple. I'll talk about that in a sec, some of the implications. You've clearly done a lot more thinking than we might realise, given your responses to the questions. So that's very clear. Yes, it is a depressing picture. 0.75% expenses. Is anyone had a look at St. James's Place lately? Like realistically, way, way, way more wealth is extracted each year by the financial sector. And I think something has to be done about that. We talked about people making decisions. We mentioned Martin Lewis. He's one of the few people that's trusted. Mm. And can you blame people for that? I think things like that have to really be faced up to. But in illustrating that a bit more contribution makes a lot of difference, I think you've done that, even if we might say assumption's a bit oversimplistic and you haven't allowed for volatility and that sort of thing. I think you've certainly achieved that, and it's a good starting point for further thought.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think in answer to sort of the volatility and things, when we were originally scoping out this work, we had planned to do stochastically investment scenarios, so that would have obviously included volatility. But then it became, given the timelines involved in the budget, we had to do 16 people, and then it became that the focus was really on the people, and if we stated our assumptions and made sure that they were reasonable enough, it was more on people's decisions than economics, I guess, surrounding it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely something that would have been very interesting to include.
Oh, yeah,
you go and then you can go next.
Okay. Oh, Anthony Kerr. I don't qualify for any classes, any prizes. I don't know if anyone saw the Times yesterday. The front page, there was an article to the effect that life expectancy was going down in some parts of the country. So, you know, I think the idea that longevity will go on and on improving is completely wrong. But one aspect I would mention is that so many people had mortgage endowment policies, so they've also got the mortgage debt when the policies mature. Now, it's not appreciated the way it should be that these people can make complaints and win. So I'll send the way such cases can be won and send it to anyone else if they're interested. But they are definitely.
We'll take the next question. I think we've only a few more minutes, so if anybody, particularly if another student would like to ask a question, otherwise we know who the champagne's going to.
Jodie Glennie, unfortunately I'm not a student. I'm really interested, this type of research is clearly really interesting to a group of actuaries sitting in a room. I guess what I'm really interested in is how you think you can use this with end consumers to help improve the pension saving situation.
I think Marilee's speaking to her family and scaremongering them into increasing their pension contributions is a sort of a good, you know, that's a good example of how actually the messages are quite simple and clear. I think encouraging people to have those conversations is a good start. It's a difficult one. We have been speaking about our research mainly to groups of actuaries who I like to think have made adequate provision for their own retirement. But we wrote the report with a target consumer of advisors in mind. So perhaps by reading our white paper, advisors can help sort of steer their customers in the right direction, but then appreciate that people who've got advisors perhaps aren't those who can, you know, barely afford a 1% increase in contribution. So it is a difficult one, but I think it's just, again, the kind of education piece and incumbent on kind of industry advisors, government and financial professionals to just try and kind of show people that it's not always a massive big change. And despite my use of the word scaremongering, it shouldn't be a scary kind of thorny topic. So I think the kind of gently approach can work, and yeah, education rather than telling people to do something and not giving them a good reason why.
Okay, we've time for one final question.
Hi, Sarah O'Sullivan, fellow. I just had two comments and one question. To the person who thinks that the state pension age or the state pension might go up in the future, the Government Actuaries Department recently published their figures, which said that they expect the state pension pot to run out by 2032. So I think it's probably a fairly sound assumption that that probably won't go up. I think it's a real testament to you both that, you know, what I imagine was really time-consuming and quite a lot of work was delivered in such an effective manner that it might have come across as simple to some people in the audience. I thought it was a very interesting talk. My question is, it's commissioned by Royal London, and it might be slightly, you know, not really a question for you guys, but what are Royal London planning to do with this kind of information?
So Royal London published quite a bit of kind of thought leadership and research papers, as a lot of insurers do. And they wanted a paper that they could talk about with their advisors and I think just kind of to promote their identity as kind of people who are doing thought leadership in the area and to look at ways in which advisors can help their customers. So they're sort of as an adjunct to this work. There was a piece which we did, which is sort of private between us and Royal London, unfortunately, which was looking at sort of ways in which product providers can help. So, the kind of ability for them to leverage this for their kind of self-promotion, I suppose, and also kind of the wider project generally gave them some product development ideas.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. I'm going to award a bottle of champagne to Con Keating. No? Okay. Well, I hope the next person I'm going to will still, you know, you still asked a great question. Neville Kent. And then, I'm really sorry I didn't catch your name even the second time around, but the second bottle of champagne is yours. Again, Beatrice and Mary Lise, thanks a million, and for your great responses to all the questions that were asked. I'll just remind everyone that there are feedback forms in the room outside, and we'd greatly appreciate if you took the time to fill them in, particularly the questions around our registration process and check-in today. And please do join us for drinks and sandwiches if you have time. Thank you very much.